And this is the second in our series on Dancing Under the Wings as part of Under the Covers, Women, Men, and the Image of God. Yesterday, I think we left off at a point where I want to identify two paradoxes. A paradox is, as you know, what appears to be a contradiction. Two apparently contradictory whatevers that really are in sort of creative tension with each other. Each end of a paradox sort of needs the other to be complete. And what at first looks like somehow doesn't hang together and is contradictory really is, you know, a way of getting us to move forward and become more creative. And I think we really ended up at two paradoxes yesterday at the end. The first was the paradox between the aniconic tradition in the Old Testament, the tradition that says you shouldn't have icons or images, and over against that, the reality presented in the Old Testament that God is involved in making images and icons. God is iconed in the Word, and God is iconed or imaged in male and female humanity. That, at first blush, appears to be a contradiction, but it may be that it's more of a creative paradox. We're told not to have images, and yet the very one who tells us not to have images is involved in image making. The second paradox, I feel, was sort of developed yesterday, although we didn't say this in so many words at the end, is the problem of God as transcending all of the images. As many images as one might develop for God, those images, of course, never really exhaust the transcendent one. There is a passage which is one of my favorites in Zechariah 14, verse 9, which says, "In that day the Lord will be one, and his name one." Have you ever tried to imagine one? Have you ever tried to imagine ultimate one or oneness? Ultimate unity. And the paradox is that ultimate reality evidently is beyond our imaging, yet the only pathway for most of us towards ultimate reality is through imaging. There are not many spiritual athletes, although there have been some in all religious traditions, who are able finally to communicate with the divine without images, in deep meditation, for example. Or, you know, for example, in what in Christian tradition was called the negative way, the via negativa, where you finally have to get to the point where to speak of God, you end up by saying, well, God isn't like a mother. Nor is God like a father. God really isn't like a rock, nor is God like a tower. God really isn't like a judge. And yes, it's really true, God isn't a turkey, a chicken, or a goose, or an ostrich, nor even an airplane. In the Hindu tradition, this is the way of neti neti. Neither this nor that. God neither is nor isn't. God neither is and isn't, nor is not and isn't not. You can keep going with that as far as you can go, because what that finally does is it says, well, our language is always reaching towards what finally cannot be said. We may think, well, yes, we accept that for God, but I would suggest that in some ways that's also true of us. And when one learns the via negativa for the divine, one in some sense is also saying that about ourselves. We are always greater than all the images that we and others have developed even of ourselves. I like to tell my students not to belittle themselves, but to be big themselves. So we were left with these two paradoxes, the paradox of prohibitions against making images, and yet a divine being who's pictured as being an image maker, and the paradox of the ultimate reality being beyond images, as the Muslims say, Allahu Akbar, God is greater, and at the same time, our need to have images to get there. Well, I think that is a way of wrapping up some of the implications of what we were doing yesterday. There's one other implication that we mentioned yesterday, which I want to underscore again for those of you who have just come for the first time, because I expect that people are going to be in and out of these sessions, and that's the way it's set up. And that is that I consider what we're doing in all of these sessions to be entering into creation and into the creative process. Very often we are led to believe that creation is something that happened in the past. God created the world eons ago, and then we fight about when that happened and how long it took. Did it take 7 days or, you know, seven ages of days and all that? And was it 404 before the Common Era, or was it several hundred million billion years ago? And we also tend to think of ourselves that way. I was created 40-some years ago. She was created 50-some years ago. He was created yesterday. It would seem as though that's a misleading way of imaging reality. It would seem that creation actually is an ongoing process. It never ends. That God is also an open system. For those of you who like to talk in systems language, God in God's own self is not a closed system, but an open system. Hence, I consider that what we're doing here is actually entering into creation. As we image God, God is imaging us. As we grow and change, God in God's own potentiality is growing and changing. That's another paradox, because we're also told that God is always the same. It seems that the sameness, however, is that it's in process. As the French say, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. Huh? The more it changes, the more it's the same thing. But it can't be the same thing if it stops changing. That's when we usually think something is the same thing. Another paradox for the day. So as we look at Phyllis Trible's book now, I'm going to turn to Trible's God and the Rhetoric of Sexuality. Let's consider that what we're doing with her is entering into a creative process. And as she leads us into some of the feminine imagery for God, let's consider that a way in which she's also leading us into recreating ourselves and our own images of ourselves. So that we can also get beyond another real stumbling block that often occurs in our thinking, and that is the pigeonholing of what is masculine and what is feminine, as if somehow or other the twain never meet, and as if somehow or other there isn't constant interaction and mutuality going on. May I see how many of you have purchased this book already? All right. I'm going to lead you through parts of it because I think some of it is rather challenging, maybe most of it for those of you who aren't of a scholarly bent, and yet I consider the work to be very rewarding as you go through here. In her first chapter on clues in a text, Trible says that she's going to be working throughout this book on variations on the theme of that key verse in Genesis 1. Which we're told that God created humanity in God's image, and that image was as male and female. And she reminds us on page 17, if you want to make a check mark, those of you who have the book, of how metaphor works. She says, metaphor describes best the poetic mode of Genesis 1:27, what's being said in that verse. As the language of semantic motion, that means the motion of giving meanings, metaphor moves from the better known to the lesser known, from the concrete to the abstract, from the standard to the figurative. Through comparison, it extends meaning to express the similarity of difference. Think of that. Through comparison, it extends meaning to express the similarity of difference. He's a great bull of a man. Well, at first glance, bulls and men look very different. Yet the metaphor opens up something new to us about both bulls and men that we may not have had before. Most of us don't usually try, she's a great bull of a woman. Maybe we should. Or are all women really that weak? I doubt it. Try it at home sometime.
I hope you don't get a black eye.
Men like to be called that usually. I think we usually take that as complimentary, don't we? So the metaphor brings together what appear to be some things that are different and highlights perhaps a similarity that we wouldn't have noticed without the striking metaphor. Tribble goes on. This semantic process involves the cooperation of two elements, a vehicle and a tenor, spelled like a tenor in music. The vehicle is the base of the metaphor, the better known element, while the tenor is its underlying or overarching subject, the lesser known element. Therefore, for example, when you say, God created human beings in God's image, male and female God created them, the vehicle, the better known element, is what? Between image of God and male and female, which is the better known element? Sure, we know male and female every day. At least, we're very well acquainted with at least one of those, and usually pretty well acquainted with the other. It's the image of God that's the tenor. Somehow, male and female are to be to us the clues for what God is like, or what the image of God is like, because in fact, the image of God is itself another vehicle. The image of God is not yet God, who is always greater. And so in this case, if we say God created humanity in God's image as male and female, you have two vehicles going towards an ultimate tenor or intended reality. Male and female are the vehicle to get at the image of God, and that poetic idea of the image of God is itself a vehicle at getting towards God, and one could even argue further and say, and the word God is yet another vehicle to move towards that which is inexpressible, neti neti, which is neither this nor that, but is beyond all our languaging. Another way that you might explain this is one that I like to use with students, and that's the old Zen lesson. There's a wonderful old Zen story about the person who's standing pointing his finger towards the moon. And the vast majority of people are looking at this person and wondering, why is he standing in this strange posture? And they check the arm, and they check the wrist, and they check the finger. Of course, that really wasn't what the whole idea was it? It isn't really the finger that was supposed to get all the attention. It was the moon towards which the finger was pointing. Well, the fingers that are going to point now for us in Phyllis Trible's studies are feminine images for God in the scriptures, and specifically in the Hebrew scriptures. In chapter 2 of her book, Trible talks about the journey of a metaphor. And in this chapter, she comes down on a case in point in the Old Testament. And that is the Hebrew word rachmim. In English, R-A-H-A-M-I-M. A hard H and a small A after it. It's pronounced something like rachmim. Want to try it? Rachmim. Oh, come on. Rachmim. A good H. Pretend you're German. See? Rachmim. Good. And a verbal forms that are based off of it in Hebrew, you can do it in several ways, with the three basic letters, resh, chet, mim, R, hard H, and M. This word basically means womb or uterus in Hebrew. Rachmim refers to a woman's uterus. Do men have uteri? No. Okay. But in the scriptures, because also in the Hebrew language it is used this way generally, it comes to have a second meaning. Womb takes on the secondary meaning. In fact, in the text very often this becomes a primary meaning of compassion, motherly love, care. And so, if you say that someone has rachmim towards you, you see, has compassion towards you, if you want to be really strict in the translation, you would have to say, the person is feeling womb-like feelings towards you. Or if you say, maybe I'm feeling womby, if you want to make up a word. I made up that word, by the way. I haven't seen it anywhere else in the literature. We do have a word in English, you see, that uses this, but it's pejorative in the other direction. We like to say that women tend to be hysterical. All right, that simply is the word from womb again. You know, all know what a hysterectomy is. But we use that pejoratively. When you're feeling hysterical, we tend to think that that's negative. Well, in the Old Testament, when God or anyone is feeling hysterical, it means overcome with motherly love, care, and compassion. Well, I don't want to try to change our word hysterical in the language, so I've thrown out a neologism, woomy. If you can think of a better one, I'd like it, because it's not the greatest of all possible words. Trible points to... Yeah, you got one?
Could you please tell me what pejorative
means? Pejorative means in a negative way. When you use a language pejoratively, you use it to put down someone or in a negative way, rather than positively. Okay.
A modern parallel in New Zealand, the secretary looking at our band said, it makes me feel so clucky.
Clucky.
So the second secretary came in and said the same thing. It's so clucky.
Like a hen, yeah. Is that it? As an aside, that reminds me of something yesterday when we were talking of all these images, like, you know, the Lord is my shepherd. I was told once by a person who was working on Bible translations for people in New Guinea that they couldn't use that translation because they didn't know sheep. So they hit on the Lord is my swineherd. Most of us don't tend to think of ourselves as pigs in a positive way. We tend to think that's pejorative. That's right. Tribble points to three sets of passages in the Hebrew Scriptures in which God is related to wombs. The first set, there's a distance between God and the wombs. There are these commonly known stories in which God is said to open or close a woman's womb. Can you think of a couple of very famous ones? Yeah, you know, the wives of Jacob, Rachel and Leah, God either did or didn't open their wombs. Another one someone said. Hannah, yes, the mother of Samuel, and the famous one,
Sarah,
sure, Abraham's wife. Those are all stories in which the God is related to the womb, but sort of on the outside, almost like a doorkeeper, opens or closes the womb. But Tribble says there are some other passages you can look at in which the God becomes a little closer than that. In fact, there are passages in which the God is said to be at work within the womb. Any come to mind? Yes, the call story of Jeremiah in Jeremiah 1. God says, before I formed you in the womb, I called you. I think there's one in Psalms also about, yes, how I was knit together, how the Lord knit me together in my mother's womb, something like that. So here you have a very close relationship between the God and the womb. But even that doesn't exhaust the possibilities. The really powerful images are those in which the God acts in a womby way, in a womby manner, in which the God acts with rachmim, with compassion. And Tribble discusses several passages in her chapter 2 here in which God is pictured as reacting in a womby way. And I want to only zero in on two of those because they are really, I think, her parade examples. The first one is in Jeremiah chapter 31. And if you have a Bible, you might want to follow along. Scholars argue whether Jeremiah himself wrote this or another editor, but it's quite irrelevant for what the passage itself says. So, for the sake of discussion, let's let Jeremiah be the author of this. I sort of like Jeremiah, so as much as I can give him, I like to give to him. It begins in verse 15. And Tribble, very, to my mind, very winningly, labels this little section a drama of voices. She discusses this in her book on page 40 and the following. Jeremiah 31, verses 15 to 22, she says, is a drama of voices. These voices organize structure, fill content, and mold vision to create something new in the land. Now, the setting is this, that the people of Judea and Jerusalem, most of them at least, have been taken away by the Babylonians into exile in Babylon. We're in the 6th century B.C. And the passage says, thus says the Lord, a voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. It is Rachel weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted for her children because they are not. Nice imaging, huh? Mother Israel, here pictured as Rachel, Jacob's favorite wife, and the one, as you remember, who had trouble having children, and that rivalry she had between herself and her sister Leah. And of course, she had the two favorite children, Joseph and Benjamin, and now they're gone. They've been taken into captivity. Very poignant. Here's Mother Israel in the image of Rachel weeping. You hear her first. Then you hear a response from the God. Thus says the Lord, keep your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears, for your work shall be rewarded, oracle of the Lord, and they shall come back from the land of the enemy. There is hope for your future, oracle of the Lord. Your children shall come back to their own country. So that's voice two, the voice of the God. Now we have voice three, and this time it's a masculine voice. It's Father Israel, here personified as one of the largest of the tribes, Ephraim. I have heard Ephraim bemoaning, thou hast chastened me, and I was chastened like an untrained bull calf. Bring me back that I may be restored, for you are the Lord my God. Because after I turned away, I turned back, and after I was instructed, I began to smite my thigh in shame, and I was confounded because I was bearing the disgrace of my youth. And now again, the divine voice interrupts, and this is the key passage. Is Ephraim my dear son? Is he my darling child? For as often as I speak against him, I do remember him still. The RSV now translates, therefore my heart yearns for him. I surely will have mercy on him. Now, if you only read that passage as it stands in the RSV, you do get the picture, do you not, that the God here is entering into the parental imagery. You've had Mother Rachel weeping. You've had Father Ephraim bemoaning. And now you have parent Yahweh speaking about his or her child. The clue, Tribble says, is in this wonderful concluding section. Therefore my heart yearns for him. I will surely have mercy on him. Listen to her translation. It's on the bottom of page 45, those of you who have the book. She says here, it is female imagery that surrounds Ephraim. Words of a mother embrace her son. Because you first had heard Mother Israel, Rachel, speaking, then Ephraim. But now, in a sense, it's Mother God that speaks. Here's her translation. Is Ephraim my dear son, my darling child? For the more I speak of him, the more I do remember him. Therefore my womb trembles for him. I will surely show motherly compassion upon him, oracle of Yahweh. And she's not just making it up. Because the language in that verse in Jeremiah talks about the innards of God. May I. And it's the same language that's used in the Song of Songs. We'll look at this on Thursday, those of you who come back. For sexual imagery, when a man enters the innermost parts of his lover. These are the innermost parts that are yearning, God says, for the child. And the next response is, therefore I will have rachmim on him. Al kein hamu me'ai lo rachem rachemenu ne'um avanai. You almost can hear it in the language, can't you? Innards just churning, but these are, as it were, a woman's innards. You'd never guess that, would you, from the RSV? Now here's a place where translators could help our imagining if they would adopt Phyllis Tribble's very excellent translation. Therefore my womb trembles for him. I will truly show motherly compassion on him, oracle of Yahweh. So here is Ephraim now, cradled by his mother's. Rachel here, Yahweh here? Yes.
I accept what you're saying. However, is it not possible?
You really don't have to accept it or not accept it.
If the thing is that she's making the assumption that man cannot have the innermost feelings that a woman can have.
Mm-hmm.
And I take exception with that, because I think with my son and with my children, I have the same feelings expressed in this passage.
Well, I would think that this is precisely what Tribble would like to have you become aware of, for those who aren't aware of that. Remember, the argument always begins from Genesis 1:27, which is the image of God is male and female. It's not male or female. Sometimes God feels like a male, sometimes God feels like a female. It's male and this is to be a clue also, yes, to the way that men are.
I think she made a mistake. She should have started in 26. You said 27, didn't you?
All right, I may be off by a verse.
But you're right. She starts on 27, but she should have started 26. Because it says us and our.
Oh, well, she discusses that too. I haven't discussed everything in the book.
Yeah, and I think that brings in the point that within us and our, obviously,
no, she's discussed that too. There's more than that. I can't do every single thing out of the book.
Okay.
In fact, I prefer not to do every single thing out of the book because you're supposed to do that. But that's right, yes. This is precisely what Tribble is trying to get us to do. She's trying to open up feminine characteristics that are often suppressed in men. And though she doesn't talk about it as much, I'm sure that it wouldn't be far from her thought that, women ought to be opening up towards some of the masculine characteristics that are suppressed in them. In fact, the book itself is a cipher of that. I mean, this is about as masculine a project as you would ever want to read, this book. It's done by all the rules of rhetorical criticism, of literary criticism. It is as rationally constructed a book as you'd ever like to see. There is nothing hysterical about this book. I mean, this is, Richard, this is your good rational thinking here, you see. Trust me. But see, there's a cipher here in the very fact that she's doing what we usually consider a man's job in writing the book this way, even. She does it according to all the, the good rational rules for writing a book, for doing a literary study, and so forth. So I think your point is very well taken, but don't criticize her. If you criticize me for not presenting it completely.
If I can just try and summarize for my own benefit.
Sure.
Maybe some others as well. Not being here yesterday, what she's pointing out is, is the original Hebrew word the rock meme?
Yeah.
And she's elaborating upon its meaning.
Right.
That it has more gender qualities than.
Than we usually suspect.
Than we suspect.
Right. Okay. That's right. And she's also, I think, she hasn't done this, but there have been some other women who've been working on Old Testament passages who have said, well, it isn't as though translators haven't been aware of that. I mean, you can read this in all the word dictionaries and things that are on seminary shelves. But when it comes to daring to translate those passages that way, everybody always pulls back. Because they're afraid, well, but if we say this, it's going to really confuse people. They're going to have to think of God both with feminine and masculine images because, the Trinitarian doctrine says God is Father. It never says God is Mother. And why confuse people? So we discuss that in seminary classrooms, but let's not lay this upon, the ordinary schluckers out there. Tribble doesn't say this, but there have been some other women in Old Testament studies who put this on the line and said, well, and doesn't that also show a distrust in the readers, in the audience, that they will not have the create They will not have the imagination. God has not touched them enough so that they can enter into this creative process. The creative process is only for a few people over here who know the secrets, the esoteric few. And the great masses, remain on pablum, as it were.
This seems almost unbelievable that this imagery then would be suppressed until this, the past few years. For all the time that we've been translating scriptures for ages and ages and years and years.
I'd like to hear Richard respond to that. You do more things with psychology than I do. I mean, suppression usually isn't something that you consciously do, is it? It just sort of happens.
Repression
is conscious.
I don't know that it's a conscious effort as much as it's a result of a male-dominated society that simply took what it wanted. Right.
Sure, we become... We're simply inducted into traditions that are already there, aren't we? And then we just sort of...
The flow never caught on to what else is left.
Yeah. I think that's right. And take some courageous voices once in a while, saying, this really is the semantic arena in which we're working here. Why not underscore it a little bit in our translations? And if the translation seems especially provocative, maybe that's what we should have. Take away some of the boredom and wake people up and make them look again. Well, I think if one wanted to really attack Tribble at the base, I've not seen anyone do this yet. I'm surprised someone hasn't. But I think one could probably attack it and say, but now wait a minute, Phyllis. You're doing the same thing that Mary Daly is doing with all your word games. It really isn't the fact that when most people use language after it's developed a while that they remember all of these semantic milieus, out of which those words originally come. The words take on new meanings and those original, semantic areas become forgotten. And it certainly is true that in Judaism, God is overwhelmingly male, but they've made up for that too because there's this wonderful mystical tradition about God's presence. And the word for presence in Hebrew is Shekinah, which is feminine. And in poetry, the Shekinah always comes like a mother and hovers over Israel. And they also have done it. They've compensated for it in the ritual life. Every single week, Queen Sabbath is welcomed in. And the mother of the family says the prayers that welcome in Queen Sabbath. And there's also a mystical tradition in Judaism that pictures the throne upon which the Divine One is seated. And the throne, the moving throne, is the Merkavah, which is also feminine. And that links you up with this marvelous old tradition in Egypt, where the Pharaoh is always seated upon the lap of his mother, because the throne is Isis personified. And you can't have a powerful Pharaoh without the protective arms and the lap of Mama. And in the Hebrew mystical tradition, you don't have the Lord without the throne upon which the Lord is seated. So there are ways in which the feminine has been brought in, even when this feminine imagery around Rachamim has been sort of forgotten. It comes in another way.
Bill, isn't coming it up here. Also, it still is a patriarchal religion.
Talk real loud for the mic.
It still is a patriarchal religion in the sense that they have suppressed a lot of images, as far as acknowledging things. But isn't it historically, if I recall, that a lot of this, when they're writing it down, is a reaction against a lot of female imagery historically pre-Hebrew?
Yeah, that's another story, and that's a complicated and involved story.
It's sort of like you're suppressing this because you're saying we're not like these other religions, right?
Yeah. So. It has something there to do with keeping the God transcendent. What became the Orthodox picture here in the scriptures that were finally gathered, there's a real concern to keep the God transcendent. Why? Because, this is a little bit off topic, but it may be important, it has to do again with historical reality. When the people of Israel were taken from their land and taken away, you know, in the ancient world, what always happened? The gods were also taken captive. And so what finally happened in these scriptures is there, the emphasis was always to make the God different, beyond, and transcendent. And one of the best ways to keep the God transcendent is then to get rid of all the sexual imagery. That's too much at home. And so you finally end up by emphasizing, wait a minute, our God is beyond all that and doesn't have to have a feminine counterpart in order to create the world. But there was a price that was paid for saving God.
It's out of an historical context, yeah. And we forget that, and we are also part of an historical context,
sure.
Too.
That's right.
So it's not surprising to me that this has been suppressed because of the context that we live in.
And had they not paid that price, it's unlikely that the people as a people would have stayed together. Well, when one sees the richness of the imagery, see, one really has to think more again in terms of paradox, ambiguity, ambivalence. And it appears to me that when we do that, that in fact we learn much more about ourselves. My own experience has been that we really come in for troubles in our lives when we start defining ourselves in one or another category. And I guess, again, Richard could probably talk more intelligently about this than I can. But it appears that one of the problems we have to do is we need to define ourselves. We don't want to be in this Dionysian world where everything's open and there's no definition at all. On the other hand, if we make the definition so hard and fast, how can we grow? How can we respond to unexpected situations? Where are we open for surprises? Does that sound reasonable?
Sounds real defensive. Real frightened, real insecure.
Which one?
The real tight.
Yeah, if you finally closed it all up. And we tend to do that with God. And therefore, it's my feeling is that when we enclose God in a few selected images, it usually is also a signal that we've enclosed ourselves in a few selected images. And then that world becomes one that we really have to defend at all costs. And when the God images begin to open up, my experience has been that also then the personal images begin to open up, and we're able to enter more into creation as a process, joyfully rather than, you know, with great fright.
That may be a chicken and egg issue. Maybe it's only personal. Is they able to open up if the God images open them?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure which you're defending, God or your own psyche.
That's right. If you're a Jungian, you know, you say that those finally come together at the place where the opposites finally coincide. But the opposites do not blend. They complement. They don't. It isn't that the humans and the God become exactly one any more than a man and a woman, when they become one, become so much one that they lose their separateness. You become one together, separately, but separately together, one. And it appears to me again that when marriages really have problems, it's when one or the other has decided the other won't be separate. I cannot be in your image. You will always be in my image.
I think it's great to have word study and to find more in the scriptures than we've taken for granted by reading casually. On the other hand, is there not a danger of finding some of these interesting little sidelights and then exaggerating them all out of context? Just for instance, two things mentioned this morning. The one, to make so much of the feminine ending of a Hebrew word, seems to me rather questionable.
You mean as the Jewish people did in their Merkava mysticism?
Yeah, because so often there's a masculine use on the verb afterwards and so forth. It doesn't necessarily mean that a feminine ending noun naturally is feminine because you look at the verb. It's not.
Right.
Okay. The second thing,
but in the imaginative spirituality of the people, that is what developed. And therefore, I don't like to come at it afterwards and say, you know, and judge and say, well, they shouldn't have done that. Because to my mind, that's a very creative movement that complements the image of God. Since it's become rather impossible in Jewish theology to you know, make the feminine images of God in God's own self, you bring it as close as possible in the presence, the Shekinah, and the throne, the Merkava, and in the number one spiritual celebration, the Shabbat, every week. And so, in fact, you sort of surround this thoroughly masculine divinity. Again, the male is surrounded by the female, as it were. And so they are there, complementary, in a complementary tension.
I don't want to rule it out, but I say, yeah. I think the tendency to make maybe too much of it.
Yeah.
Secondly, I think as far as she is concerned, to make so much of the fact that male and female...
Why do you say too much? Certainly. I mean, why is it too much? Too much of what?
Well, let's just take this illustration. In verse 27 here, God made them male and female and so forth.
Back to Genesis, all right.
In the image of God, okay? May I not rather, as we've had a tendency to do, read a period after him? The next sentence now talks about blessing them and having children, okay? So male and female created he them as a new thought, not a definition of image of God.
Well, there you would have a problem because, and I think, because now you're ruining the poetry.
Yes.
Hebrew poetry likes to deal in parallelisms, and it's the sentence is not complete without the male and female part.
The next one is.
Let's see.
If you take it with the next phrase, no problem.
Well, I'd rather not argue that today. but if you and I would like to sit together, I'll be glad to do some poetry with you.
I really want to point out that this is a foundation stone in her whole
thought. Sure it is.
And maybe questionable.
But you're reading it in English. There has a lot to say with what
and I've forgotten
the difference of
learned.
Direction.
Well, no, I think your argument probably is one that a lot of people would like to raise and perhaps are a little reluctant to. And my answer to that would be that when you have had a portion of the psyche suppressed, and when that suppression has not only been personal, but when it has been collective, then it seems to be only fair that you begin to overemphasize that so that it gets at least the minimal attention it has always deserved.
Yeah, I think there is a danger in taking the imagery too far. I think the problem is that the male imagery has been taken too far. And so, you know, we have a difficult time getting the language and getting the concepts, and we have to struggle to do it because, in a sense, we've been trapped in taking one part of the imagery too far. So we have to make an effort to recover the paradox, to come back. And like I say, I think the authoritarian male God image in a sense, has maybe been carried too far. And for me, it's always been a problem in terms of getting the Old Testament connected with the New Testament because I don't see Christ in that way. And as you described this, there seems to be more consistency and meaning coming out of it.
In fact, when you and I sit together sometime personally, then I'll bring to you some of my thoughts of Christ being, in the sense of a liberator,
right,
very much in the warrior, very much in line with the warrior God of the Old Testament. So. We'll let you know when we have these personal discussions if anything you want to sit in on. I want to move on because time is a-wasting. Tribble also discusses an interesting passage. I'll let you do this one on your own if you'd like. In 2 Isaiah, chapter 49, so this would be just a little bit after the time of Jeremiah, or perhaps around the same time, depending on whether Jeremiah or an editor wrote chapter 31, again, middle of the 6th century. It's Isaiah chapter 49, and I'll give you the verses so you can do some looking at it. And then if you have some questions on that at the beginning, tomorrow if you come back, you can address them at the beginning. It's 49, beginning at verse 13 and running up, well, through 16. 49, 13 through 16. another very powerful section in which feminine imagery and this imagery of the womb and feeling womby is used of Israel's God. The reason I don't want to spend a lot of time on that is because my ego says I need to discuss a chapter that Tribble somehow or other decided not to do. I know she's aware of this one, but she decided not to bring this one up. And it's the one in Hosea 11, and it's one of my favorites. And I want to do that in the last 3 minutes that we've got remaining. By the way, before the tape goes off, I want to also mention that tomorrow we will look at a particular segment of Scripture and a particular woman. We'll be looking at Genesis chapters 2 and 3. It's Phyllis Tribble's chapter 4. She entitles it A Love Story Gone Awry, and it's the story of the first man and the first woman, Adam and Eve. So if you want to read ahead and review Genesis 2 and 3 before tomorrow, if you're coming back, please do that. The chapter I have in mind is Hosea chapter 11. If you have the book that came off the shelf here, it's on page 782. And it's a wonderful passage for illustrating what Abraham Heschel calls the pathos of God. The God of the prophets is a God who is moved and can be moved, much like we are moved emotionally. God is pictured as a pathetic personality, a person who can be moved. And it's again parental imagery. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. A metaphor for the Exodus. But the more I called them, the more they went from me. They kept sacrificing to the Baalim and burning incense to idols. And yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I'm the one who took them up in my arms, but they didn't know I was healing them. I led them with cords of compassion, with the bands of love. I became to them as one who eases the yoke on their jaws, and I bent down to them and fed them. So as a parent to a child, or as a kindly master to a work ass or a work ox, all these wonderful, nice things, and of course they turned against the gods, so anger. I'm going to send them back to the land of Egypt. And Assyria will become their king because they refuse to return to me. The sword will rage against their cities, consume the bars of their gates, devour them in their fortresses, because my people are bent on turning away from me. I've appointed them to the yoke, and no one will remove it. Complete twist of emotion. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? My innards are recoiling within me, and my wombiness is getting warm and tender. I won't be able to execute my fierce anger. I won't be able to destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not a human being. I am the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come to destroy. It's the most powerful passage in the Old Testament scriptures. Turns of emotion, love, anger, remembrance of the past, and climaxing in this picture of God like the mother overcome with this sort of womby compassion. And as Mr. Hansen said earlier, in Hosea, God is very much a masculine figure throughout. And so here is this very masculine God feeling very feminine at this point. At the same time that he's feeling very masculine, he's raging. He's about to devour, he's about to slay with the sword. But his hysteria overcomes him. His womb gets the last word. And it's a good thing for Ephraim that it does. I think we're off tape, but if you want to have a last word.
Isn't there some of that, you know, Hal's point earlier was that maybe as males we have those same feelings, you know, we have those same emotions for our children, those same yearnings and
sort of thing. The semantics of it may be in a feminine gender, but the feelings are still not foreign to me as a male. Maybe there's something to be said that there's male and female.
I would suggest that maybe one reason they're not foreign to you is because we're already at the point where the women have helped us to realize that they don't have to be foreign to us. And when we have the feelings, the first response that we have doesn't have to be, that's not really me, forget that.
Yeah.
We can allow that to develop. Someone here wants to respond to you.
I was thinking that one of the reasons that it's sometimes hard for us to look at the language of the Bible and think about change in that regard, and we are afraid, because it's easier to have a set idea of what God is like and live only in that small portion. And whether we acknowledge it to ourselves or not, we think that then we've got God figured, and God in our box, we often say, corner. So we know exactly what God is like, and for anybody to say, you didn't think of God this way very often, just kind of hits us right in the middle of the stomach.
Until we get to the point where we start acknowledging God and ourselves as open systems, and then suddenly there's this, like these weights that just start falling away. At least that's been my experience. So suddenly you butterflied into a whole new world. And I think that's what resurrection is about.
It makes God much bigger. It's really great.
I think that's what resurrection is about. I think you're going to have less.
Just taking that a step further, and then when we look at what's happening in the world and listening to the voices of theology from other places, I mean, that's just mind-blowing.
Yeah. These are the times.
These are the times.
We are the people.
These are the times.
We are the people.
Take care.